Arjun Das. You're listening to Forbes Avenue on WRCT Pittsburgh 88.3 FM. I'm joined today by Dave Mawinney. Dave, how's it going?
It's going great, Arjun.
Yeah, so Pittsburgh is known for many things. Winning at football, losing at baseball, pierogies, steel mills, and soon enough it might be known for something new, tech startups. That's in no small part, thanks to our friend here, the efforts of today's guest, Dave Mawinney. Dave is the executive director of the Swartz Center for Entrepreneurship at CMU's Tepper School of Business, which is one of the premier hubs for startup activity in the Pittsburgh metro area. So, Dave, you're a Pittsburgh kid. Tell us how you got to startups and how'd you find out that it was a viable career path?
Oh, wow. So, I grew up a grandson of a steelworker, the son of a Presbyterian minister. So I was at the low end of the middle class. And when I graduated high school, the steel industry tanked. And everybody left town. And I was seeing some people be successful in other cities. I would read Forbes magazine. I would read Fortune magazine. And they would talk about the entrepreneurs. And I would think to myself, why not? Why couldn't I pursue that? And so it was something that stuck in my head through my undergraduate education. And I was actually getting a PhD in physics at Georgia Tech. And I realized that the tech side wasn't the side that I would be the best at. It was at the selling side. And so I decided then to be an entrepreneur, and that led me back to Carnegie Mellon, where at the time it was pre-internet. You couldn't learn to be an entrepreneur on the internet. You had to go to business school to be an internet. And Carnegie Mellon had one of the best business schools in the world, and it had one of the first entrepreneurship programs in the world. In 1971, the president of the university, Dick Seyert, hired Jack Thorne to start the first entrepreneurship program at any university. So that reputation led me here. And from that point, I launched my entrepreneurial career.
Interesting. So what was the first company that you founded?
Yeah. So a guy named Don Jones was a successful entrepreneur in the Pittsburgh area. And he gave $1 million in 1989, which was a lot of money in 1989, to found the Don Jones Center for Entrepreneurship at the Tepper School of Business. I was very fortunate to be a student at the Tepper School at that time. It was called GSIA, the Graduate School of Industrial Administration. And I said, that's the guy I'm going to start a business with. So I stalked that poor guy. And so there was an event downtown. It was called Entrepreneurs Day. And there was, you know, it was like a trade show. But they had a VIP lunch. And you had to pay to get into the VIP lunch. So I snuck in the room and found the table with Don's name on it. I took two chairs and I put them up like to save the chairs. I snuck back out of the room, and it was like festival seating. So I ran and I snuck and got first in line at the door. And so they opened the doors and I ran to that table. And I sat there with my arm on the table with the chair, so no one took that chair next to me. And Don came in and I jumped up. Don, sit here. And so he came over and sat down right next to me. And at the time, he said he was going to retire from startups. And so I worked through the lunch to get my courage up. And I was nervous as hell. And finally, I looked at him. I said, Don, entrepreneurs never retire. You're going to start another company, and you're going to start it with me. And he started to laugh at me. But it wasn't like he was laughing at me like I'm an idiot. It was like, I can't believe you had the cojones to ask that question. And that started the relationship, and literally, we started the company while I was still a graduate student here at Carnegie Mellon, and it was called IndustryNet, and it grew in time to be the largest business-to-business site on the early internet in 1995. There's a rest of the story that I can tell you a little bit later in the Q&A, but that's how I got my start.
Awesome. Yeah. So what was like the biggest thing that you learned from starting that first company? I'm sure there were a lot of lessons, but one that comes to mind.
Great, great question, Arjun. Don Jones, my co-founder, was a great engineer and one of the greatest marketers that I have ever met. And so you would think I would answer, oh, this product development idea or this marketing technique. But it wasn't that at all. Don said to me very early on in our relationship, he said, Dave, everything good about a company is the people, and everything bad about a company is the people. And so if you're going to be successful as an entrepreneur, you need to focus on getting the very best people and creating a very good culture so that you can get the best productivity and the best version of those people every single day. And so that's something that I've remembered all my life, and it's something that we do now at the Swartz Center in programs like the Innovation Scholars, which Archon is an Innovation Scholar at the Swartz Center.
That is true. So how'd you end up at the Swartz Center and running things at CMU?
Archon, I was pissed off. Do you know what I was pissed off about? MIT and Stanford were seen as great entrepreneurial universities, and Carnegie Mellon was not. Yet in research and academics, we were their equals. And I'm like, why? It doesn't have to be this way. And so, you know, I had been a multi-time entrepreneur starting companies, and I've also been a venture capitalist. So I knew the business inside and out. And I knew that we had the talent at Carnegie Mellon to get there, but we didn't have the culture. We didn't have the buy-in from the top of the university, and we didn't have the confidence in our alumni base to go start companies. Oh, we had really great entrepreneurs. Did you know that the iPhone, the first four versions of the iPhone, were designed by Matt Rogers, who's an ECE undergrad and ECE master's here? He went on to found Nest Labs.
Yeah.
Sold it to Google. It's now the Google Home platform. And now he's doing one of the coolest new startups called The Mill. It's taking food waste from your home and dehydrating it and turning it into chicken feed. That guy is amazing. And he started companies 10, 15 years ago, right? And we had people like that throughout our history. Adobe is a CMU startup.
I didn't know that.
Sun Microsystems is a CMU startup. But nobody knows these stories. So I wanted to come back and help Carnegie Mellon take its rightful place next to MIT and Stanford as a great startup university.
That's great. Yeah, I mean, I think everyone here would like to see CMU become one of those top dogs.
Well, we were just ranked the number three entrepreneurship university by Bloomberg Businessweek. And research at the Stanford School of Business by Ilya Strebulev, who studies where venture capital goes, on an index basis now ranks Carnegie Mellon number four in unicorn founder creation.
Wow. Well, congrats to you.
No, not me. Dude, this is a community, right? The one thing second idea I learned from John Jones is it's about the people, and then it's network, 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 right? And so we've built a network of people that help each other. We have a global village at Carnegie Mellon.
I'm curious about one thing. You know, you talk about Stanford and Silicon Valley. A lot of times that culture, that network, can be seen as something that just arises naturally, but part of your job is enacting concrete things that help create that network, help create that culture of entrepreneurship. What are some actions that you try to take to help make CMU the next big entrepreneurship university?
There's many. I will try to narrow it down to just a few high priority ones, not necessarily in any order. One is to provide the right framework and methodology for people to think about how to go about starting a business. And the one that we use here at Carnegie Mellon is one that's used many other places. It's called a lean, agile approach. And what people don't realize is that's really just the scientific method applied to business. And so these basic fundamentals, first principles, if you teach entrepreneurs to use them, then you can greatly increase their probability of success. So we try to give them the fundamentals, and then we try to give them the network. And there's 125,000 living CMU alumni all over the globe, and every single one of them should be a customer of our startups, a supplier to our startups, a mentor to our startups, and an investor to our startups. So we work really hard to leverage that network. So one-third of my job is connecting with investors, venture capitalists, angels, and getting them to recognize that Carnegie Mellon is a great source of startups to invest in. We've created an angel network through a group called 99 Tartans, right? We've put an investment fund inside the Swartz Center called Venture Bridge, a pre-seed investor fund. And it actually sometimes writes the first checks into the companies. So if you think about that, you know, we've got the fundamentals of how to approach building your startup, and we've got this network that can help get you customers, it can help get you investors, and where do you think the best talent source in the world is?
Right here.
Oh! How did you guess? No, I mean we're being, you know, kind of funny about it, but the reality of it is Carnegie Mellon attracts the best and the brightest from all over the world. We get 3,000 new students that walk on this campus every year, and they're amongst the smartest people in the world. It, metaphorically, it's a renewable energy source, right? 3,000 of the smartest people come here. And if we can get them to understand that entrepreneurship is a career path for them, then we can build this beautiful network. We get a network effect that happens.
What are Pittsburgh's strengths and weaknesses as a future startup hub? Like, why should someone stay here and start a startup instead of moving to the Bay Area?
It's a great question. I'll start it off with something that a lot of people have heard of. Duolingo, which is one of our most successful Carnegie Mellon startups, stayed in Pittsburgh. And they wanted to recruit people as boomerangs that were out on the West Coast. So they put a billboard up on the 101, which is the highway that goes up and down Silicon Valley. And that billboard showed the picture of a Victorian mansion. It says, "See what $300,000 in Pittsburgh can buy you?" So there are a lot of great qualities about Pittsburgh. But one that might not be top of mind for people is, did you know that Pittsburgh was the Silicon Valley of the Industrial Revolution? Why do you think it was?
A lot of steel.
Well, before steel, we had all of the resources, the minerals to make coal. Yeah. We could get iron ore from Minnesota across the Great Lakes and down the canals that were built. We had rivers to transport steel that was made. Alcoa, the Aluminum Company of America. PPG, Pittsburgh Plate Glass. The Heinz Company was one of the first manufacturers of mass-produced food. All of these companies were here, and they created great wealth, which created foundations. And those foundations allowed Pittsburgh, even though we were a smaller city, to punch above our weight and to be a major league city with arts, with museums, right, with major league sports teams, right? And so we had all the amenities that a New York City would have, or a San Francisco would have, or a Chicago would have. But we had a small town feel, and we were affordable, right? Mm-hmm. You could buy a beautiful house in a nice suburban setting that's 12 minutes from downtown. That's my house, right? So there's a quality of life here because of all the amenities from our history and the affordability. Now, you mix that with the talent at Carnegie Mellon, and you've got a strange brew that's pretty great.
Yeah, I can imagine. I mean, it seems like a pretty good town from how you're pitching it. Just a reminder, you're listening to Forbes Avenue on WRCT Pittsburgh, 88.3 FM. I'm your host, Arjun Das, here with Dave Mawinney of the Swartz Center for Entrepreneurship at CMU. When a lot of people, just regular people in the population, think of tech startups, they think of gentrification and hipsters with very expensive coffees. What are some of the ways in which startups can be positively transformative for a community like Pittsburgh? Why should a regular person want startups here?
You know, you talked about the veneer, the surface. You know, that exists. We can't change that. But the great entrepreneurs are not focused on how they look or how they're perceived. They're focused on delivering value to their customers and solving real problems, right? So again, that's one of the principles we try to teach our entrepreneurs is identify real problems that people need to solve, solve them better than anybody else can solve them. We have a concept called the goodness factor at the Swartz Center, right? And be humble about it. Don't be braggadocious, right? You don't see the folks at Duolingo who've created something brilliant actually out there bragging about themselves all the time, right? Mm. They've got this great Midwestern humility about, yes, we're proud of what we're doing. It's great, but we are doing it in service of our customers and our employees. And that's, you know, what we try to build here at Carnegie Mellon is value focus for your customers and be humble.
That makes sense. So I guess switching back to CMU, let's say I'm a starry-eyed freshman who's just come here for the first time and doesn't know much about startups, doesn't know much about entrepreneurship, but wants to learn more, wants to get interested in the scene. What are some things that I can do to help me get more involved in startups and you know, eventually achieve my dream?
The simple answer, and I'm going to give you a longer answer too, the simple answer is come to the Sports Center, right? We're a hub for, you know, making your entrepreneurial dreams come true. But here's the longer answer. A lot of these kids come here with a bad mindset from either their parents or from their teachers at their high school, which is you should go to work for the man or the woman. And you're the smartest people in the world. Why the hell would you want to go to work for a soul-sucking consultant, a bean-counting banker, or an evil tech monopolist when you can work for yourself? You can guide your own ship. You can, you know, determine your own destiny if you work for yourself. Now, obviously, that's a big joke, right? I'm just trying to sort of have a muse that we can bounce off of. Consulting companies, banks, tech companies are great, okay? But I want to help change the mindset of these young people that there is an alternative path. And the truth is, the research shows that entrepreneurs are happier than people that work for other people. And the reason is not because you get rich. That's a nice side effect, right? The reason that entrepreneurs are happier is they get to choose their own path. They have true freedom and liberty, right? When you're an entrepreneur, it's up to you. You make the decisions. Of course you have a boss. Your board is your boss. Your customers are your boss. Your employees are your boss. But you get to make the decision. And I'll say it again. To me, that's true freedom and liberty.
Is that sense of independence one of the reasons that you first got into entrepreneurship?
Absolutely. I went to work for a very large company in Pittsburgh as an intern, both in undergrad and during my graduate studies. And I was eager beaver, and I was the first person there, and I was the last person to leave. And what I noticed is people were coming in at 10, and they were leaving at 4, looking at their watch all day long. I felt I was in a zombie graveyard, and I said, there has to be something else. And that's what led me down. I had already decided I wanted to be an entrepreneur, but like many people, I was sort of dipping my toe in the big company water to see, does it make any sense? And it made no sense to me. And so I felt that, you know, I didn't feel like I was better than anybody else, but I felt like I could do what other people could do. So what did I have to lose, right? I used to joke and say, I came into this world naked. I'm going to leave this world naked. It doesn't matter what I'm wearing in between, right? So I had no fear of failure. And so that's why I did it.
Yeah, so you probably get a lot of startups across your desk on any given week.
Hmm.
So what's one interesting one that you've seen recently that you'd like to share with our audience?
Oh, Arch, and you're asking me to say who my favorite child is.
Doesn't have to be the favorite, just the one that takes your interest.
Oh, so we have a lot of really cool ones. And I do get to work closely with a lot of different companies. One that was in the Sports Center today while we were doing our Connects workshop series was a company that's now called Trainwell. They recently changed their name from Copilot. They actually had the name Copilot before Microsoft came, but Microsoft came in and branded Copilot, and all of a sudden everybody was asking them, are you part of Microsoft? But Trainwell is amazing. They have built a one-to-one personal trainer capability on your smartwatch and your smartphone. And they enable a trainer who, if they were doing it in person, could maybe train 10 people a month. They allow that trainer to train 200 people per month using artificial intelligence. So they are just created this amazing capability. They started off, interestingly, thinking gym bros was their target market, the guys you see upstairs in the university center trying to pump themselves up, wearing those muscle shirts, right? And they actually found out women in their 30s that didn't want to go to the gym, that wanted someone to push them, wanted a sense of belonging to a community, even though it was online, was their target market. And they pivoted to that, and they've been growing incredibly rapidly. I think that's amazing because it's just one of the gazillion uses of artificial intelligence to improve people's lives. And why we're sort of specially suited to do that is artificial intelligence was invented here at Carnegie Mellon in the early 1950s. And robotics was essentially perfected here in the 60s and 70s. And so we have this opportunity to create new companies that are doing the most amazing things out of artificial intelligence and robotics.
Yeah, so Trainwell is definitely doing some really cool stuff, and they found their niche. I'm curious, a lot of times it seems like startups are very difficult, obviously, and you have to work a lot. Yep. And at times it might feel like it's an uphill battle. What are some advantages that startups have over their competitors who are larger companies? Like, what are some things that startups can do better than a large company?
Well, startups are more nimble, right? Because of their smaller size, because of the mentality that the founders and the early employees bring to the table, is they can respond more quickly to customer needs. They can respond more quickly to, market changes. They can respond more quickly to technology trends that change. So, for example, startups in 1995, the internet hadn't really existed in a mainstream way before that. And the company that we started, IndustryNet, actually was doing a printed publication and an electronic Yellow Pages we distributed on a diskette. But the internet happened, and we moved all of that information online and immediately became the largest business-to-business site on the internet, right? So if we were a larger company, we wouldn't have been nimble enough to make that change literally almost overnight. So that's one thing. Another thing that we have, if we build the right culture in a startup, is that our employees are excited to come to work every day. They're focused on delivering value to that customer, and that can drive a what we call a goodness factor, a value proposition that's compellingly better than what the competitors can provide.
So there are some advantages to being a startup over a big company.
Not some, many.
Many, many. So what's your passion? You clearly come to work every day and you're a really excited guy. What gets you out of bed in the morning?
So the story I didn't tell you about why I'm at the Schwartz Center is I'm a Western Pennsylvania kid. I told you about the steel industry and metals industry going away and everybody leaving. And I had a concern that my children and my grandchildren might not be able to live in Western Pennsylvania if we did not have a diversified economy. And the eds and meds industries brought Pittsburgh back. But what I worried about is without a diversified economy based on technology and new things that were happening in the marketplace, that we might again face a plateau or a decline. So I wanted to build a startup community here that was vibrant. And when I looked at all the assets of the region, the number one asset was the people that come to Carnegie Mellon. So the reason that I come to work with a smile on my face and energy every day, Archon, is the people like you. I mean that sincerely. I just love the people that come here, and I want them to be able to, you know, follow their dreams and not feel boxed in by other people's perceptions or misconceptions.
Everyone at CMU who's interested in startups owes you a lot.
Thanks. Well, they owe themselves a lot, right? I mean, this is a community. It's a village, right? And it's really important to address that all the time. It's like, we have to be together to make this happen.
What are some of the things that the Schwartz Center does, some of the activities that you would like our audience to know about?
Well, first of all, the Schwartz Center is named after Jim Schwartz, who's a Pittsburgh native and a CMU alum. He started the one of the top, if not the top, venture capital firms in the world, Accel, A-C-C-E-L. If you don't know the firm, you know the companies that he invested in and his team. They invested in Facebook. They were the first institutional investor. They invested in Slack. They invested them in when they were a different company and pivoted to become what they are, and a whole bunch of other companies that you would know. Jim, believed the same thing that I believed, that Carnegie Mellon was an underutilized resource and that we could use the talent that came through Carnegie Mellon to build great companies and to build great economies. And so at its core, that's what the Schwartz Center is about, is to attract the best and the brightest and to help them by providing them the tools and the resources to actually be able to take their ideas and turn them into reality. We have 24 different programs and clubs at the Swart Center. It's not a one-size-fits-all capability. Anybody that comes in is going to take a different path than the others. We have a venture fund called Venture Bridge. We have a competition called the McGinnis Venture Competition. Some of my favorite programs are like the programs that you're in, Argent, the Innovation Scholars. And the Innovation Scholars is like a sorority or a fraternity for high potential entrepreneurs. And we have high diversity in that group. We have people from the different schools across campus. We have people from different ethnic origins. We have people from different lifestyles. You name a way to look at diversity, that's what we have. You're not an Innovation Scholar. Why don't you tell us really quickly what an Innovation Scholar is? I'll be the interviewer now.
I would say that Innovation Scholars has been a really good program for learning that entrepreneurship is a real thing that you can do. I think when I first came to college, I was like everybody else. I wanted to get that, you know, shiny looking job at Google. But I quickly found out that the thing that would fulfill me the best was probably working at a startup. I just didn't know how to make that real. And Innovation Scholars allowed me to connect with other students of the other Innovation Scholars, as well as meet this wide variety of really incredible people, these founders, these investors that we met when we went on our trip to Silicon Valley. So every winter break, the Innovation Scholars get taken on a week-long trip to Silicon Valley. And overall, it's been a really positive experience. So,
yeah. And the amazing thing to me, Archon, is that the alumni from Innovation Scholars are absolutely killing it. I can't believe how many great companies have been started by people that have been in the program that you were. You mentioned Matt Spatel a little bit earlier from Trainwell. Stella Hahn started Fractional, a way for friends to buy investment real estate properties together. Glenn Wise came to CMU last week. He started a cybersecurity company called Cinder. Mohawk Nada started a company called Atlas to make it easier to get visas to go back and forth to India and China and other places. I mean, the people that have been in this program are really creating life-changing companies. And that's what our goal is that we didn't do that. Those people did it on their own. You know, they came up with the ideas. They made these things happen. But we hopefully created an environment that gave them the confidence to do it and some of the resources they needed to get there.
I'd love to hear a little bit more about that environment. Paul Graham, the founder of Y Combinator, probably the biggest accelerator in the world.
The biggest and the best in most people's minds.
Yeah. He grew up in Monroeville, so
he did. He's from a Pittsburgh native, yeah.
And he gave this talk on the future of Pittsburgh as a startup hub. He seems to be bullish about it. But one of the things that he talked about was these organic conditions for entrepreneurship to occur. Mm-hmm. Things that happen to correlate with founders meeting each other and starting really cool startups that go on to do big things. What are some of those organic conditions that you think are most important for the development of a healthy startup ecosystem?
Community, a sense of community, a sense of belonging, a place to go. And that's what we didn't have before the Swart Center, and we do have right now. Now, the Swart Center can't be the only place and the only community that we have in town. I think that's what Paul's talking about. You know, he started off in Boston with Y Combinator and moved it to the Bay Area. The Bay Area has all these micro communities that are just incredible. We're not going to try to recreate what's going on in the Bay Area, but we can create these micro communities that are here in Pittsburgh, the Swart Center being one of them. So I think if you get these micro communities that are, you know, successful and vibrant in and of themselves, working with other micro communities to build a larger ecosystem, then you can have that success. And so, you know, I'm very proud of what our team has built at the Swart Center, but we need more of that in more places. So I would like to see the University of Pittsburgh build upon the microculture and the micro community that they have there right now. I would like to see us be able to do that in downtown. What you've seen with Carnegie Mellon is the influence on Lawrenceville and the Strip District through Robotics Row, right? So even though that's connected to Carnegie Mellon, its own micro community down along the Allegheny River. So if we can do more of that by creating these hubs of, you know, startup activity, I think we have a chance to be what Paul Graham thinks we can be.
It's been really great having you on the show, Dave. Again, this is Forbes Avenue on WRCT Pittsburgh, 88.3 FM. I'm your host, Archon Das. I was here with Dave Mawinney, director of the Swartz Center for Entrepreneurship at Carnegie Mellon's Tepper School of Business.
Forbes Avenue is a production of WRCT Pittsburgh. The opinions expressed are those of the participants and not necessarily those of WRCT, its members, or Carnegie Mellon University. Email questions or comments to pa@wrct.org.
You're listening to Forbes Avenue on WRCT Pittsburgh, 88.3 FM. I'm your host, Archin Das, and today we're here with...
Erica Hyde. I'm a senior park ranger for the city of Pittsburgh. I work out of the Department of Public Safety.
And we're here to learn a little bit more about the deer management program in the city of Pittsburgh. Thanks for coming on the show.
Of course.
So tell us a little bit more. What is the deer management program?
Yeah, so the deer management program is a effort to control the overpopulation of white-tailed deer in the city of Pittsburgh limits, specifically looking into our parks, which will then result in benefits for our local residents around parks and throughout the city as a whole. So we were approached by a group of citizens within a neighborhood organization, primarily within the Friends of Riverview Park, which is up in the north side of Pittsburgh, and that was also joined by the Squirrel Hill Urban Coalition. And they kind of merged together and formed a group of concerned citizens, specifically between their two organizations, but also citywide, that were complaining about the effects of deer, primarily across the city, eating their vegetation, potentially being in vehicle collisions with deer. And they wanted to take that effort and that interest and formulate it into a deer management program. So when we met with them, we were basically just the people to help get that legislation through and also formulate a deer management program that was effective, but primarily safe for all of our parkgoers and citizens visiting the city of Pittsburgh. So,
sure. Within the deer management program, I think when most people think about a word like deer management, you're thinking about what seems like sort of science-y methods, sterilizing deer and such. Mm-hmm. But the deer management program in Pittsburgh actually involves hunting. Can you talk a little bit more about why that choice was made?
We evaluated both non-lethal and lethal methods for deer management as a whole. So we very early on looped in the USDA, the Department of Agriculture, to help us through this process. They're experts in it. They've been running deer management programs for way longer than we have. We also looked at other parks around us that match kind of our, you know, demographic and our acreage and whatnot. So we really like Cincinnati's model, and we basically took Cincinnati's model, worked with the USDA, made a couple tweaks here and there, and we came up with our solution. So right now in Pennsylvania, you cannot legally do any sort of non-lethal deer management. It's primarily, the big thing is it's not going to help handle the deer population that we have as of today. We are already overabundant. If we put in non-lethal methods, one, they're not going to be very effective. Two, they're going to be extremely expensive. But three, they're not going to handle the deer population we have right at this minute, and we need to bring that population down to a sustainable level before we could even consider any sort of non-lethal options. But in the state of Pennsylvania, we can't do that. We can't do sterilization. We can't do trap and relocation, and we cannot do a birth control. It's not FDA regulated or approved in the Pennsylvania region. So we chose a lethal method. It was both cost-effective. We could do some really great things with it, like donating to local food pantries and whatnot. And also, it was handling the deer population that we had at this moment as a whole. So that is why we went with a lethal method versus the non-lethal method.
Cool. So you're a park ranger. What's the involvement of the park rangers in this program?
Yeah, so we are working in our parks every day. We're seeing the effects of overpopulation in terms of an environmental stance. So we're looking at the issues of an agricultural but also landscape issue. We're seeing our understory that's basically depleted. If you go, I don't know, Schenley is a great example. It's a local park here. If you go to Schenley and you're in the woods, you're on the bridle trail, you shouldn't be able to see clear to the Greenfield Road. You shouldn't be able to clearly see up to the Schenley Oval. We should have an understory. So I always tell people that go camping, go hiking. If you ever go up to McConnell's Mills, you see those lovely rhododendron forests. They're thick, but you can't see up to the next trail because that understory is so thick. Here in Pittsburgh, we don't have that, and that's because of the deer population. Our deer are hungry. They need food, and they're going to eat those understory covers. And without an understory, without a healthy understory, we're going to start seeing an increase in stormwater runoff and potentially even like landslides that lead to this. It's all basically a spiral of a demise. And when you add deer, an overabundance of deer as a whole to it, you're basically taking gasoline and pouring it on the fire. So this is one thing that we can manage now and help out our ecosystem as a whole.
Yeah, I mean, I've walked through Schenley Park many times. We live right next to the park. And I guess I never noticed that the sort of lack of vegetation on the ground is because of those deer. But you're saying that's like a major factor causing mm-hmm. that?
Yeah, it's a major, you know, it's a major issue in Pittsburgh parks as a whole. And, you know, if you ever walk through the park and you see new vegetation being put in or any sort of new trees, you see tree protection going on. You see tree tubes, you see tree caging, even deer fences and deer enclosures that are installed all throughout Frick Park to, you know, give these trees a chance to even grow up, because our saplings can't grow without some sort of protection to keep them safe from the deer. And that even results in just natural seeding of the forest floor. You know, trees drop seeds, seeds hit the ground. Hypothetically, they grow new trees. Not in Pittsburgh, because the deer are right there to grab that sapling the minute it sprouts and eat it.
Yeah, so, yeah.
Yes.
Cool. I'm sure a lot of people, after hearing this, maybe have the knee-jerk reaction that, oh, there's people, you know, shooting guns and bows and arrows in my parks. But from what I understand, it's a very well-controlled and safe thing to do. Could you tell me a little bit more about the safety measures in place for this program?
Yeah, so for archery, everything that we do in our program has to be in line with the PA Game Commission, their regulations. And then in addition, we can add more measures to that as well. So anytime you're dealing with archery, you have to be 50 yards away from any occupied dwelling. So that's any sort of houses or whatnot. And then in addition to that, we added on playgrounds, dog parks, major amenities that we wouldn't want an archer to have to, you know, deal with, conflicting with by any means. Archery's been happening for years and all around us. Allegheny County Parks has had a program that has had archers in it, in North Park, South Park, whatnot, for before I was born, before you were born, probably. So it's archery happens. It's happening all over, and it's a safe. We have a great track record from the Game Commission of hunting-related shooting incident reports from the last 20 years showing that archery is safe, especially for bystanders. The only injuries that typically occur from archery occur when there are alcoholic beverages involved, or multiple archers, so, or potentially falling out of your tree stand. Those were the three most common incidents that happened. So we did not allow our archers any sort of alcoholic beverages, obviously, and they had to hunt alone. So we didn't have that issue of being, you know, distracted by your friend or, you know, goofing off potentially. They had to hunt solo. And these archers, as they showed in their accuracy test, they've been out hunting before. They are very, you know, well-equipped with knowledge and the skills to handle this.
So has there been a noticeable decrease in the deer population? And how do you guys monitor this sort of thing?
It is tricky to study a population that is so transient and can move such a far distance. So we did not do a population study. We do not have a recent one because it would tell us we're overpopulated. You should not be able to go through a hike in Schenley Park and see 50 deer and be like, oh, another deer. You should be excited to see deer. A lot of times the number 20 to 30 deer per square mile is the quota that they look for. So that's one Frick Park, 20 to 30 deer. I saw 20 to 30 deer in 1 hour out on the trails in like one section of Frick Park. So we know we're overpopulated. There was no reason to do a study at that time. So we didn't.
You mentioned that there were different stakeholders in this program, the USDA, the city, different community groups. Could you just walk us through who are all of the different stakeholders and what's sort of their involvement in the program?
Yeah, so I work for the city of Pittsburgh. So the park rangers are lumped in the Department of Public Safety. We are currently managing the deer management program on the city side of things. So we're also dealing with public complaints, any sort of, you know, decision-making is coming from the Department of Public Safety with assistance of City Council. Now, the USDA is a federal entity, and they're the ones proposing the contract, and it's signing through, you know, City Council with our opinions on it.
The deer management program runs during the winter. As far as, I don't know a lot about hunting, I'm not like a hunting guy, but I always thought that it was during the winter in order to maintain the deer population. Is there a particular reason that the program is running through the winter and not, say, during the summer?
So once again, that's a state game, you know, game commission requirement. So we cannot change the dates. Our dates are set by county, and that's from the PA Game Commission. So they're always in the fall. My assumption, and I am not a hunter as well, my assumption is it has to deal with raising fawns. So obviously we don't want to take, you know, potentially a mother from a fawn at that phase. So this is before mating really begins.
Just a reminder, you're listening to Forbes Avenue on WRCT Pittsburgh, 88.3 FM. The archery program is finished for this year, right?
Correct.
Has it been a successful year, and where do you see it growing in the future?
So the archery program is completed right now. I believe it was a great success. We had zero public safety incident. We harvested 199 deer in total, and we donated 14,720 meals to those in need,
wow,
which is amazing. And with that, we're hoping to expand. We are finishing up the targeted harvesting now. We're going to debrief internally and with the downtown team, and we're going to see where we can expand to next season. So we're hopeful to see this program grow into a citywide program as we are starting to develop it into our five main parks, but hopefully more in the future. So
awesome. There was another part of the program that I found interesting. The first deer harvested by any archer has to be a doe. Could you tell me a little bit more about the reasoning behind that rule?
We require the first one to be harvested as a doe because we want the archers that are in our program to have the same mindset as we want this to be conservation driven. We want this to be, you know, population control driven. And we want to see some good come from this program. So if you're not willing to donate that first year, maybe this program isn't meant for you.
Walking around Pittsburgh, you also see a lot of forested areas that aren't necessarily parks, and presumably there are also deer living there. Are you guys planning on targeting any of those areas, or how do you approach that problem?
Yeah, so we are, I say as a city, we're putting our toes in the puddle of deer management. There's so many options, so many ways you can go about it, and the ways you can expand this program is endless, but we have to start somewhere. So right now it was focusing on our larger parks that are typically residents for these deer. You know, they might wander out into the streets of Oakland, but where are they going? They're going back to Schenley Park probably to rest, you know, and resume, you know, their daily operations. But we can expand it. We can expand it to local greenways. We can even look into, I know the USDA does some work with residential owners. Like, there's so many options to expand a deer management program that we can look into. But right now we're only in year two, which is, you know, a great start. That's what we like to see. But we don't want to expand too fast. We want to, you know, work our way up to it.
So after doing a little bit of digging on the deer management program, I read about this new pilot program that's in place this year where there's like a targeted harvest with sharpshooters. Mm-hmm. Could you tell me a little bit more about that pilot program?
Yeah. So last year we introduced archery. This year we introduced archery in more parks, but we also added in a targeted harvesting aspect to the program. And targeted harvesting is only happening in Frick Park and Riverview Park up in the north side. It is contracted out by the USDA, so it's only USDA contracted employees that are coming in at night and they're removing deer. They are removing deer with firearms. They are suppressed. And they're doing this at night. So our parks are closed at 11 p.m. I don't know about you, but I'm not out past, you know, 8 p.m., but they're starting closer to, they're starting at 11 p.m. or later, and they're working throughout the night, and they are off-site, out of sight by 6 a.m. when the parks reopen.
How many hunters are out there for the targeted harvesting program?
So it is just a one vehicle unit that is operating. So there are three guys within one truck, someone spotting, someone driving, and then someone shooting. So, and they are obviously using thermals and nighttime vision to make sure that they have clean, safe shots before they ever take them.
I feel like that's like an interesting image to have in one's head of like a sort of squad that's just out there to shoot deer. So what have been some of the community reactions to this program?
Yeah.
You mentioned that there was some involvement from community organizations at the beginning.
Yeah, I would say I started this job in 2017, and I would say there was no way that we would have ever gotten a deer management program off the ground. The public was just not to that level of caring about the deer population. And in the last, you know, 5 years, I've seen so many complaints, and the Gainey administration finally was like, we're going to do something about these complaints. We're going to handle the complaints about deer coming into our yards, eating all of our gardens, you know, how many vehicle collisions we've had over the past, you know, 20 years, just increasing. So the public really kind of fueled this program. Like, they were a large part of getting this program up and off the ground. So a lot of complaints that we had were more like curiosity, like, how do I know that this is safe? I don't want to see an archer. You know, I bring my kid there to the playground. Like, I don't want them to be exposed to this. And a lot of it was more just like, once you sat down and explained the program, everyone was totally understanding. And they want to see something happen with the deer population. They might be upset that it's a lethal control method, but once they understand that non-lethal is not an option at this moment, they're usually okay with it.
Could you talk a little bit more about the effects of the deer population on the plant life in the area?
Yeah, for sure. So, as I said, you know, deer eat a lot, like 7 pounds of food a day. That's a lot of food for, you know, Pitt did a study saying that they looked at the more economical side of deer management, but they made this prediction looking at prior studies that we might have up to 300 deer in Frick Park at a time. Take 300 and times it by 7. That's a lot of food being eaten every single day. So when deer are eating, they're munching on the, we'll say the native vegetation is the what they prefer. That's what they want. They want our gardens. They want, you know, our local or our native flora. So when they eat that and they remove it from the ground, because typically they pull and rip and they take the roots and everything with it, that leaves an open spot in our forest floor. Traditionally, what would happen is native seeds or whatnot would come in and fill that and hypothetically fill that void. But when we have 300 deer doing that at the same time, we're left with major gaps in our forest floor. So our ground has these gaps, and what's going to move in and fill that? It's probably going to be something that is deer resistant and traditionally an invasive species. So that's one of the reasons that we see things like garlic mustard, we see Japanese knotweed, and we see these species thriving in our parks because the deer aren't eating them. Nothing wants to eat them. So it's hard to replace once you start getting into, we're starting to spiral into more invasive predominant forest versus a native-based forest. And once you start that spiral, it's really hard to catch up. It's really, really hard to catch up. So we're seeing our native forest being replaced with more of an invasive-based forest cover or understory that the deer are not eating. And they're flourishing. They're doing great. But on the other hand, we see a deer population that's hungry, that's starving, and they're now starting to resort to moving out into the streets into risky environments or potentially even munching on invasive species that we have never seen them eat before. I saw a deer munching on Japanese knotweed in the middle of the summer, but that's what the food source was available for them.
Well, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Of course.
After speaking with Erica, we wanted to learn a little bit more from the perspective of the archers who participate in this program. We're catching up with one of them today, Walter Martin. Thanks for coming on the show, Walter.
Thanks for having me.
So why don't we start off with you telling us a little bit about yourself?
So I am an avid outdoorsman. I love being outside. I love hiking. I love going to the national parks. I like fishing. And I like archery hunting. So I love being outside. I love watching nature.
Sure. How'd you get into hunting and archery in the first place?
You know, I was, I used to be in a business development position in the golf industry. And with that, I was a lot of the places I would go, golf courses, were in areas that were, you know, woods, nice habitats. And they would talk about hunting and being like somebody who loved the outside. I just started to learn, like, what they were doing, and I got involved.
So do you only hunt with bow and arrow, or do you also hunt with guns?
I have only hunted with bow and arrow. So the bow and arrow season, the archery season, is from September through November. And so it's a beautiful time of the year to be in the woods.
Yeah, yeah, that makes sense. So on the deer management program, I guess, how did you hear about the program in the first place?
So as you... you know, follow, you know, on Facebook, there's sites and pages that are dedicated to archery hunting. And it just came up in one of the groups. So I applied for it. you know, one of the challenges with archery hunting is trying to find places to hunt and also places that are convenient.
Awesome. And within the city, where do you hunt? Which parks?
I hunt Frick Park.
Frick Park. Awesome.
So Frick Park, it's split up into 10 different zones, and a hunter is assigned to each zone.
Okay. So you can only hunt within the zone that you're assigned?
Correct.
Okay. That makes sense. So on a typical day when you're in the field hunting, just like walk us through your process. Like, what do you do to prepare when you're at home? When you show up, what do you do to set up? And like, what's it like? What kinds of hours are you maybe normally out there?
Since, you know, archery is fun and a sport, like we practice. So like really, when does it start? It starts in the spring as you practice and just keep getting better and better being archery and figuring out what you can do and what you can't do is what your limitations are. So it starts really with practicing and like moving forward as the season comes close. I would take walks in Frick Park around the area that I was planning to hunt and like see if I could see deer movement, see if I could see trails and prepare for that. If you're talking about like day of, like, you know, usually on Sunday, which is a non-hunting day throughout the state, I like will just double check my equipment to make sure that everything's fine and I'll just practice a little more. And then I'll have my gear in my vehicle. Like the day of, I'll show up maybe, you know, if it's early morning, I'll show up before the sun comes up and leave by, you know, an hour or two after the sun's up. I try to walk in with civilian clothing on, not camo. I carry a backpack and I have my hunting clothes in that. The bow, I hunt with both a compound bow and a crossbow. I carry those in a bag. As a big a plastic black bag. I pick up trash on the way, and I just try to not make anybody nervous. So, like, my pre-hunt, that's basically it. I do have trail cameras out there when they're allowed 2 weeks before the season starts.
Hunting deer in Frick Park is a little bit unique in that it's in the city instead of, you know, in a more suburban or rural area like most hunting that I think people are aware of. What are some of the differences between hunting in Frick Park and hunting sort of out in the woods in the middle of nowhere?
The deer feel bubbles of safety. And like on the trails, they know they're humans. And like the deer have been very comfortable around people. They were a lot more 2 years ago when it started than they are right now. But if you were within what they would consider their bubbles of safety, like in between the trails, in the woods, like they would get spooked when they saw people in places they didn't normally see people. I mean, that part's different. I think the real key is the approach to hunting. First off, safety is number one. So when we're scouting our territory, it's so, okay, this is going to be a good spot that's not going to endanger anybody. But we definitely know, okay, this is, I can shoot uphill here. If I'm shooting in an elevated position, the arrow's not going to go anywhere. It's not going to fly. It's not like a gunshot, like a bullet that can travel a long distance. I don't think people realize we really don't shoot over 20, 25 yards.
Oh, pretty short.
Yeah, it's pretty short. And that's another huge difference in urban hunting. And especially with Frick Park and especially with this program, shot selection's unbelievably important. We have to look for a double lung shot that's going to put the deer down really like down quickly. In the wild, I've shot a deer that the arrow passed through its heart, and I think it still ran 80, 90 yards. If we're hunting in an urban environment and there's houses, you know, 80 yards can mean three or four houses. 80 yards can mean it runs towards the soccer field that the kids are practicing on.
Are you guys responsible for dressing the deer?
Yes, we are.
Okay.
So they have a station at all the parks where you would remove the deer and then field dress the deer.
Is this your first year in the program?
Second year.
Have you noticed any decrease in the number of deer?
Absolutely.
Okay.
A huge difference. The first year, deer would almost follow me in the woods. Yeah. Like they were so docile. Like they were, and there were so many of them. It's definitely dropped down.
So if you could nerd out a little bit, what gear do you bring on your hunts? What kind of bow?
So I have two types of bow, two bows that I bring. One is a Bowtech compound bow. And that's, you know, and one is a crossbow. Crossbows have higher power. And I think it has more downing. Like it's, you know, for double long shots, it's probably something that would help put the deer down as soon as possible.
Difficult. Could you talk a little bit more about the testing process? Do they take you out to a range somewhere? Or?
We go to a range. You know, there's target set up. You don't know in advance what your target is. You don't know the distances. So you guess and practice. Like I practice, and for practice, I practice farther than I would like shoot like in the field. Mm-hmm. So they have three separate targets and you go there and you get one shot in each and you have to hit in a small window. And if you don't, you're out. Mm. I tried out both years. If you harvest a certain amount of deer, I think it was four, you were invited back. So
how many deer would you harvest in a typical season?
So I think the average was about, you know, six or seven. So
out of, on average, how many like trips do you think people are taking out to the parks in one season?
I think just off the top of my head, I think it was around, you know, 15 to 18. Candidly, I was a little more because I enjoy being out there.
Yeah.
So I love walking. So I would walk and just see what was going on. I'd jump in a tree and watch. And, you know, sometimes deer would walk onto me. Like, it's like we are outside enthusiasts. So I saw a buck come out, and there was a raccoon that was around. The raccoon was walking up to the buck, and they were playful together, you know, and the buck, like, put his horns, like, it was like, and then the raccoon crawled up the tree and rested and flopped down in between three branches and fell asleep. And when it woke up 20 minutes later, it looked at me and its eyes got as big as saucers. It had no idea it was there. And then he like crawled away. But it's like you see cool interactions like this. You see fox. You see like, you know, birds. Like it's just beautiful out there. So I think I was out there about 30 times.
Oh, that's awesome. So it seems like you enjoy participating in this program a lot. What's been your favorite parts of it so far?
So it's a combination of being out and like, and again, enjoying the outside, enjoying like the sport of archery and of deer hunting. Part of the deer hunting too can be in part stalking and figuring out. It's almost like figuring out how are deer behaving? How is it different here? Like, what adaptations do I need to make here? Versus like being out in a state games land out in the middle of nowhere. You know, there's that. Honestly, it's also, you know, I do, you know, intervention and treatment advocacy for people in drug addiction and alcoholism. You know, part of it's service to the city. You know, it's, you know, there is a problem. There are people like with car accidents and things like that, like that I just think like I can be a part of. And I think the donations of hundreds of pounds of venison for the food pantries, I think is pretty cool. I feel really good about that.
So just to wrap us up, if you could tell our audience of people in Pittsburgh anything about the deer management program that you would like people to know, what would it be?
First, I really appreciate the support of the people that I've walked, you know, like that I feel like I'm a member too of the Frick Park community and how much support that we've gotten. I think we're feeding a lot of people, and I feel really good about that. Again, with my real job being in drug addiction and alcoholism, you know, I am by homeless shelters and I am by places that I know that they're getting, you know, good solid food and we're helping people out. Another thing, it's incredibly safe. We take 20, 25 yard shots. You're safe. You're like, your dogs are safe if there's on leashes. And I ran into a rabbi who was a little concerned because she saw a deer probably maybe like 60 yards away. She saw me and she's like, you're not going to shoot my dog, are you? And I started through the process and she was like, it's so safe. I go, yeah, you're totally fine.
Awesome. Well, thanks for coming on the show. You've been listening to Forbes Avenue on WRCT Pittsburgh, 88.3 FM. Today, we caught up with Walter Martin, one of the archers participating in the deer management program run by the city of Pittsburgh.
Thanks a lot. I appreciate you.
Forbes Avenue is a production of WRCT Pittsburgh. The opinions expressed are those of the participants and not necessarily those of WRCT, its members, or Carnegie Mellon University. Email questions or comments to pa@wrct.org.
Hey, I'm Richard Gordon, and welcome to Forbes Avenue, where we are joined today by Annie Carnes, the Senior Marketing Communications and Development Manager of the Light of Life Rescue Mission. Thanks so much for joining us, Annie.
Thanks for having me. Appreciate it.
I was raised in the city of St. Louis, so I can remember all these urban development projects that would come along, and things would be condemned by eminent domain, and people would be moved out of their houses, and one of the results was homelessness.
Yeah, so, you know, there's a lot of, at least since COVID and the pandemic, there's been a lot of movement around terms like urban redevelopment, eminent domain, and just in general, how it affects homelessness. Of course, we know that it causes displacement of our low-income, you know, residents in Pittsburgh. It causes gentrification issues due to the rent increasing. And the biggest one that we've seen is just, in general, the loss of affordable housing. You know, new developments tending to be, of course, higher costing, pricing out people that have been living in their neighborhoods for decades. So it's just overall increasing housing insecurity. And something that we talk about often at Light of Life are those just reasons why someone becomes homeless to begin with. You know, we serve over 3,000 unique individuals every year just through our emergency shelter, those that are experiencing homelessness. And all of them have unique stories. You know, some of them, their stories, you know, are...
Mom and Dad used to argue about everything, especially about Dad's drinking. My family went from totally crazy to quiet, calm, and even peaceful when Mom started going to Al-Anon family groups. I wanted